Hello, this is Father Hayward Ewart, a priest and a Christian psychologist, the author of Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. The book is published by Loving Healing Press, found on the internet at lovinghealing.com. I wish to begin with a story about a man who is now 65. It points out the fact that child abuse occurs with boys as well as with girls. And the statistics regarding the frequency of abuse between boys and girls are not very reliable because we have no way of knowing how many cases are actually reported. It may well be that just as many boys or more are abused as girls. We do know that child abuse is a pandemic. It is all over the world. And it is infecting our country, and it is on the increase. The chapter I am going to read is entitled A Man's Story, and it begins, "Another man, now in his mid-60s, still has monthly or more frequent dreams of conquering his father, who has been deceased for over 30 years. He remembers as a boy watching his father proudly weave two leather dog leashes together for training the family pet, a pedigree boxer. At the end of the two woven leashes, he attached a hard, wrapped ball, somewhat larger than a golf ball, which he formed by tightly winding a long leather thong. He left some remaining strips dangling loose off the end of the ball to resemble a cat of nine tails. Even at his young age, the boy wondered why such a device would be needed to train a dog. Not long after the project was complete, the boy learned that the weapon was for him, not the dog. He had been accused at age 7 of talking back to a teacher, something he had not done, and which he tried on and on to explain to his parents. But his father took out that odd weapon. The man remembers the horror of not being able to get away, incapable of standing, trying to scurry under the kitchen sink, only to be yanked straight in the air by one arm so the father could get another series of blows in. On and on it went until the boy believed it would continue until he was dead. A few days later, when previously scheduled physical exams were conducted at school, the doctor asked what happened upon seeing the black and blue stripes and shapeless wounds from the chest down. The victim said that he had fallen. The doctor did nothing. Before, when he was younger, David was always excited to see his dad come home. He would watch for him to appear up at the end of the block and run to go meet him. He would get a great big welcome from Dad, and it was the best part of the boy's day. Sometime after the beating, while still in elementary school, David came to believe in God. But that only made things worse, because now there was someone even bigger and more powerful to keep at bay. So in order to avoid his wrath, the boy would stop whatever he was doing many times during the day while playing, and kneel down, then bend all the way forward to kiss the ground. The bizarre act became a magical way of keeping God from attacking him or his mother. He dared not stop the ritual, no matter how much the other children laughed at him. It was better to undergo complete humiliation many times every day than to take a chance. David had no imaginary power of his own. Instead, the ritual held the power. He cannot remember how long that behavior continued, but he estimates more than a year. He did not have any real interest in girls until he was 15. Even then, he preferred being with his friends. The guys he would explore the sewers with and go camping with and watch late-night horror shows with. They were kids who did not fit in with the cliques at school. They were the in-betweeners, very intelligent, but interested in nothing, fully capable of academic excellence, but not considering college preparation something that would be natural for them. They simply existed. One day in 10th grade, there was a girl with a very pretty face sitting across the table from David in their classroom. He was moved to speak to her, and to his astonishment, she spoke back in a warm, encouraging way. After a few dates, a problem arose. She said that she did not want to be with somebody who had only a D average and on the verge of failing algebra. Dolores was her name. She was an honor roll student. So he knew that he had to start trying, even though he did not really believe that he could ever do any better. As they continued to date, Dolores seemed to build David's experimental self. She gradually, over many conversations, started to make him think that he was intelligent and even had a special mission in life, perhaps being a pastor or something, even though she made it plain that she would never marry a pastor. Dolores seemed to have serious problems with her parents and sisters. As she and David talked and caressed intimately time after time over the next 2 years or so, she made him think he was helping her. Of course he was not, because he was a child himself. But to him, his experimental power became laced with a sense of value. It was also very clear to him how much Dolores needed him as well. The process led to mutual dependence, even though David felt the price was too high. In other words, she demanded all of his time and all of his attention. He was no longer allowed to be with any other friend. She, on the contrary, had complete freedom to be with anyone she wished, whenever she wished. David recalls one time in the summer when Dolores went with her family to the seashore and said he couldn't visit her there because she was going to try dating some other people. He was unaware then, but this condition had been set as a ploy to pull him in deeper. He did not know that he was about to become possessed by her. A merger had occurred, in David's mind, through plentiful sexual activity, not including intercourse. He had begun to feel part of her, and to have her go away into someone else's arms rocked him to his already shaky foundations. He stayed in his bedroom the whole time she was away and suffered agony beyond anything he has been able to put into words. He did not understand what was happening to him, and certainly could not explain it. All he knew was that he was living in both anguish and terror. He says had that trial lasted much longer, he would surely have died. He had fantasies of being the lead character in the movie The King and I, who wasted down to his last breath. He still cries when he sees that movie. Dolores, of course, did come back and was more demanding of his time and emotional energy than ever. Once, when David resisted one of her manipulations, she broke into violence and started hitting him with her little fists. Certainly, she did not hurt him physically. On the contrary, he came to a moment of lucidity. He became almost empowered enough to break the relationship at last. But he caved in when she came to his house hysterically begging him to take her back. David managed to go to college in a distant city with the heavy assistance of his parents, both of whom wanted to get Dolores out of their son's life. He was happier there than he had ever been. But about halfway through the second semester of his freshman year, she employed the seashore scam again and informed him that she was planning to date other people. Her daily letters had given hints of her attraction to other men, but yet they were packed with expression of passionate love for him. The double messages kept him constantly off balance. Finally, he decided to transfer to the college she attended. Her strategy had worked perfectly. They were married in their junior year. David, fed up with the mixed communications, insisted that they would either marry or break up for good. Actually, they did both. When David returned from work the very day after their brief honeymoon, He found that she had slammed a window on her hand repeatedly and had burned her arm with matches. She had also been sitting at the top of the fire escape and said she was debating whether or not to jump off. She never did. For the next 13 years, without a single break, she kept David believing that she was suicidal. Of course, it became his job to make sure she did not kill herself. The impossibility of his assignment, combined with his concern for her, and the absolute unpredictability of each day's events, constantly sabotaged his adopted self. David was forced to go to work every day without knowing whether he would find his wife alive when he returned. When he came in the door each night, he had to search for her and often find her in a closet, refusing to talk. Sometimes he would succeed in getting her out of the closet, and sometimes he would not. When he did, she would parade around either topless or completely nude, and then become furious when he wanted to touch her. The only time they had sex was when she decided she wanted to have a child. Then, when she did not get pregnant immediately, she became more suicidal. He took her to a psychologist, then a psychiatrist, then another psychiatrist, and in the 13th year, a family therapist. The last course of therapy led her to becoming addicted to both alcohol and prescription drugs. And the therapy climaxed with her running away, carrying a stash of pills, alcohol, and an antique pistol David's father had given him. After that event, the therapist refused to see her anymore. It was just as well, because Dolores had never talked, not at all, with any of the doctors she had seen. In all, David had committed her to lock-up psychiatric facilities 4 times, once with the assistance of her own mother. It was either commit her or allow the chance that she might carry through her suicide threat. Only recently has David, now a middle-aged man, actually older than that, 65, realized that his wife had numerous opportunities to kill herself, but never did. She killed David, at least his adopted self. In this 13-year nightmare, David discovered a friend, not in the form of a person, because he was permitted no friends, but in the form of alcohol. He had always enjoyed his drink at lunch and his martinis before dinner, all part of normal living according to the way he had been raised. But about 2 years into the marriage, he found that a morning drink before he left for work made it so much easier to leave. He also discovered that the same procedure before coming back at night greatly dulled the experience of hunting for his wife. He had long ago given up on God and the church that he had known. Neither God nor the people of the church ever showed up to help him, or even called. He vividly recalls pleading beyond pleading for God to help Dolores during her attacks, but no help ever came. Alcohol, however, always worked. Over the years, alcohol began to fill in the missing parts of his adopted self and to replace the wife he thought he should have some relationship with. His new friend, alcohol, filled the voids for years. After these 13 years, Dolores underwent a spiritual experience and claimed that she had spent the day with Jesus. She quit cold turkey all the medicine she had been consuming daily, along with the alcohol she had drank in enormous amounts. Then she demanded that David stop. David had no intention of giving up the only friend he had ever been able to depend on. The more she pressured him, the more fearful he became of being forced to give up his remedy. The effect was that his drinking increased, but in secret. Periodically, Dolores would catch him either by smell or by the way he acted. Then he would have to beg her forgiveness and swear never to drink again. but he continued drinking alcoholically for more than 5 years after she had stopped. Eventually, David had to stop for his own sake. A friend of his, who was a physician, found that his liver was 2.5 times normal size, that his pancreas was malfunctioning, that certain reflexes were gone. The doctor said he would be dead in 6 months unless he quit immediately. But he could not stop. There was not enough left of David to rise to the task. In the course of the marriage, the couple had 4 biological daughters. While pregnant with the 4th, Dolores insisted on having a tubal ligation following the delivery. David hated the idea with a passion. He loved the children he had, and he believed that the procedure amounted to mutilation. Dolores, backed by her therapist at the time, had the ligation anyway. By the time the youngest child was 2 or 3, she began to complain bitterly that she could not have more children. Soon after the youngest was 9, Dolores wanted to adopt a baby with mixed racial background. David had no objection, and in fact welcomed the idea of another child. He realizes now that besides truly loving children, he had a hidden motive, that another child would keep his wife occupied. She certainly needed something to occupy her. Ever since her firstborn was 9 years old, Dolores gave the children the responsibility of housekeeping, eventually including even preparation of meals. She herself did nothing except for projects that amused her for a time. When she was in her early 20s, she worked for a month or so at a children's shelter, but quit when she became pregnant. Early in that pregnancy, she was suicidal because she thought she was not pregnant. Back to David's alcoholism, he managed to stay sober on one stretch for 10 straight years. But up until 5.5 years ago, he had been detoxified and near death 4 times. Each slip, however, lasted only a few days before he would turn himself in. By adopting a second newborn daughter, again with mixed racial background, the couple became the parents of 6 daughters, 4 biological and 2 adopted. The oldest 4 of the 6 are grown with children of their own. They remember their dad being drunk only a few times, because he did not drink except during the brief relapses mentioned, and they did not last long. What these daughters do not understand is that their father was not himself at any time during their formative years. They do not know that their father continued to live out the horrors of his life as a lost and incomplete person. They witnessed a personality, but not a person. It was not David, but his false self, his adopted self, that they grew up with. David did not even begin a true discovery of his self until he gave up both alcohol and his wife for good. His final detoxification triggered what was to become a gradual realization of all the lies he had swallowed, all the manipulations he had endured, all the false guilt he had swallowed. The last binge, as David now knows, was a veiled suicide attempt. He was hoping that he would never wake up, that he had consumed a lethal amount of alcohol. When he did awake in the detoxification facility, he paced the hall relentlessly until a nurse gave him a shot. He was in a state of nauseating depression, unbearable remorse, terror, and absolute helplessness. He wanted with everything in him to die, and as soon as possible. He doesn't know whether anyone has ever wanted to die more than he did, but there was no way out as usual. Not even death was an option, because he had let his life insurance lapse, and if he died, the family would have no income. He knew Dolores would never work, And even if she did, she could never earn the income needed for the family. So here David was, a man with no life in him, but yet forced to live. The loudspeaker in the hall squawked that an AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, meeting was starting and that everybody had to attend. David sat down with the other men, dressed in pajamas and foam slippers, and then listened to the meeting begin. Then a strange thing happened. It occurred to him that maybe there was one more hope, that after all these years, this program of recovery might be able to teach him something that would finally work. Later, while lying on his bed and staring at the paint peeling off the ceiling, while occasionally tracing a roach scurrying to find cover, he made a resolution. He committed himself to life, but it must be a very different life. David told himself that he had to change everything about his approach to living. He would put all of his beliefs, convictions, attitudes, desires, everything up for scrutiny and a fresh look through the eyes of AA. He would become open-minded about every new idea he would encounter. He did not realize it then, but his first and most important task was to find the real David. Up until now, he had lived in terms of other people, what they believed, what they needed, what would make them happy. He understood other people very well, and he knew that he had been given some sort of a gift for helping people, but never had he given the slightest thought to finding himself. When he was discharged and returned home, he acquired from seemingly nowhere the freedom to disagree with some people he had never questioned before, and conversely, to agree with some he had always been at odds with. Dolores thought this was all a sign of instability, or maybe that's what she hoped it was. She had no idea that his eyes had been truly opened and that he was not going back. This new resolve, as stated, was the beginning of his getting well. That is, finding the truth about himself. He began to examine everything he had ever believed all over again, whether he had changed his mind on the subject already or not, and no matter how many times. He found himself strongly disagreeing with Dolores on various matters, especially child-rearing, even though he had never dared before. He sensed that he had chosen a rut to remain in for the rest of her life and was not by any means going to join him in his life-enhancing adventure. Whether she came or not, he was on his way, for survival was the issue. As time went on, David found he was angry at his wife most of the time, and vice versa. He had begun to dread coming home from work, because even though she no longer hid in closets, she did not do much else either. But what bothered him the most was the way she treated their first adopted daughter, whom we'll name Amy. Dolores, having become a fanatical Pentecostal Christian years before, blamed demons for Amy's being a difficult child. David realized that Amy had been a difficult child, but that Dolores had always managed the child in a wrong and sometimes crazy way, above his protests. In fact, his objections only brought down the rage of his wife on both him and the child, so there had been no win. One night when the child was only 4, David found her tied to a bookshelf by her pigtails, in which predicament the child was screaming and struggling desperately to get loose. Dolores had said the child was full of demons and had the strength of 10 men. David had promptly untied her and comforted the child, despite his wife's fury. About 5 years ago, when Amy was only 10, Dolores returned to drinking, but only before dinner. She would get extremely mellow, to put it mildly, And then after dinner, which made the buzz wear off, she would become vicious toward both David and the children, but especially Amy. This activity was during David's first year after detoxification. She would drink in front of him, and he admits buying her the alcohol. He says taking the chance of going into a liquor store was worth the risk in order to earn a brief period of peace during Dolores' mellow period before dinner. During a very rare heated encounter, David broke out with the words, "Shut the F up." Then he sprung on her the threat of divorce. Then he backed down and said he would work late and come home to see the children briefly before they went to bed, that he would sleep on the sofa and see the children in the mornings before going to school. Dolores insisted that he leave permanently. He did that very night. He says that leaving Dolores was like leaving himself, for he hadn't known where he stopped and she began. He was unable to make himself go very far in distance, so he slept on the floor of his nearby office. His AA sponsor, as soon as he learned what had happened, seized the opportunity to get David free before it was too late. For years, the sponsor and other friends from AA had warned him that his sobriety was at stake unless he got away from her. The sponsor took him to his own home with his wife and child. It had taken the sponsor about 3 hours to convince David to come with him. He did not want to venture too far from the prison camp, just like the soldiers in World War II. Indeed, the overwhelming feeling that tortured David was that of being the worst traitor in the world. In the next few months, David lost 20 pounds due to feeling too guilty to eat. It is a fact that alcoholism very often, and perhaps most often, follows abuse, whether mental, sexual, or physical. The alcoholic is the ultimate living example of a false self trying to survive without any real power. Alcoholics Anonymous can effect the discovery of one's true personhood. AA helped David greatly as time went on. He found the obvious, that his own life was as important as anyone's, and that was something he could never grasp before. He also, in time, underwent the revelation that he, and all of us, are supposed to be happy, that happiness, not misery, is the normal state of being. But the most important thing AA has done for David is to remove the fear of God as well as his preconceived ideas of who God is. David, in his own words, relates the following, quote, "The first thing to understand about God is that you can't understand God. You must accept this. The second thing to get right is that you need him. The third thing is that you are not him, and you can't do his job. The fourth thing is that he is love. The fifth thing is that he is not a theologian." David goes on, "Today, if someone were to ask me to define God, I would say that I wouldn't dare. I can't even define a human being. It would be much easier for me to say what he is not. He is not the God of wrath and punishment that I always at heart thought he was. I was afraid of him all my life, so I made another God out of alcohol. In all my religious pursuits, I had never experienced him, only heard about him through the various opinions of some famous and some not so famous people who thought they knew him. But when my very life was on the line, when I did not want to live anymore, I encountered his presence. He was in the midst of a room full of smoking, joking, non-pious, former drunks who loved each other and weren't ashamed to say it and prove it." End of David's quote. David had actually gone all the way back to adolescence and re-performed his developmental work regarding experimental identity and experimental power. His active participation in AA, including the close friends he made, who were the first since adolescence, began to give him an identity. Comments at meetings helped greatly in obtaining new and accurate information about himself. The spiritual component of AA enabled him to find a father replacement, which he termed God, my Father. The new father justified David's existence, and his belief initiated a search for a purpose in his life. This time he knew that his calling was not to keep Dolores alive, nor to make her happy. The new meaning of his existence, as opposed to his previous misconception, had to be possible. Just as male batterers do, female abusers continue to punish the former captive through whatever means they can find. Dolores has maintained her manipulation through the courts as the divorce, even at this writing, continues. About 2 years after the separation, David was returning from a meeting one night when he saw Dolores and Amy sitting in a car waiting for him. They both approached, with Dolores saying, "She's all yours. She's full of demons." David was very happy about this surprise because he loved his daughter very much, and he saw an opportunity to correct all the verbal and sometimes physical abuse Dolores had put the child through. Amy was now about 12. He was nowhere close to realizing that he had been presented with another impossible task. He was now in charge of an infuriated, defiant, and vicious child, so full of hate that her rage spread to everyone, but especially to David himself, because now he was in charge. Just as lightning tends to strike the tallest object, rage always strikes the closest person. David had no idea that he was to go through hell because of what Amy would do. He was about to experience how some children who have a very strong constitution react to abuse through outrageous behavior. They pay back. Amy had been abandoned by her birth mother, her adoptive mother, and when David left, her adopted father. Her rage exploded everywhere, and the rampage was to last for years. First, she began disrupting classes at school, then insulting teachers, then skipping school, then assisting in an apartment burglary, then running away for days at a time, then running away for weeks at a time, and finally running away for months at a time, taking haven in crack houses in the inner city. Her last long-term runaway was a 3 months until she was picked up by police. She told the officers that she had run away because her father, David, had sexually abused her from the age of 5. Even though the officer from the sex crimes unit did not believe her, and in spite of the fact that the state attorney saw nothing in the case, the Florida Department of Children and Families drew up a petition for dependency anyway. The petition violated the legalities regarding hearsay exception rules, but the court accepted the petition and granted it totally without evidence of any kind. As an aside, it should be stated that Child Protective Services agencies violate the law most of the time in presenting their petitions for dependency. There is no due process for the accused, and there is no way an innocent person can escape. Once the petition is granted, the child becomes a ward of the state. If the agency cannot build a criminal case against the accused, he is denied the right to have any contact with any minor children. In Jacksonville, Florida, Duval County's juvenile court goes along with a scam between the agency and certain favored psychologists in private practice who make their living from agency referrals. In order for the accused ever to be able to have contact with his children again, he must be evaluated by one of these few psychologists. If the accused maintains his innocence, he is labeled in denial and in need of 2 years of weekly therapy. If he admits to the alleged offense, in order to complete the process and see his children again, he is labeled a sex offender in need of weekly therapy until the psychologist discharges him. David chose not to play the game. Thus, he cannot have contact either with Amy, wherever she is, or with his younger adopted daughter, and certainly not his wife. Dolores seized upon this opportunity as being too good to be true, and immediately began a prolonged effort of convincing their grown children that David had indeed done the same to them, but they just do not remember. She pressured and threatened the state attorney to arrest her husband David. In fact, she harassed the state attorney so often that he contacted David himself and said, "Your wife is crazy." She also communicated the lie to the authorities governing David's profession so that he was driven out of business. Then, when he fell behind in temporary alimony and child support because Dolores had ruined his practice, she tried to have him arrested for failure to pay. What did the most damage to David was the fact that there is no way to disprove such an allegation. He believed that all of his children had a seed planted in their minds, that he might actually be a pervert. Thus, he found it impossible to face any member of his family. David deteriorated. Loss of his profession meant loss of a substantial part of his identity. Loss of his family was too much to bear. The threat of going to jail for unpaid child support was the final straw. He tried to kill himself. He survived by a very narrow margin and was then committed by the emergency department to a public psychiatric holding facility. From there, he managed to get himself to a distant state where his family of origin resides. With their help, he has been recovering for about 7 months at this writing. The final divorce trial will probably occur in a few months. David's future was a complete unknown, but he is actively applying for every position he can find for which he might qualify. He has resumed his search to find himself. In the book, David's story ends here, but in this recording, I want to add to the account and also provide an update of David's life. In the year 1989, he founded a church composed of former patients. It did fairly well for the first few years, but then began to dwindle as parishioners sought larger churches with more activities for their growing children. One day, during this dwindling down period, he was giving a sermon on the Lord's Supper when a priest came in to visit. The priest was so struck with David's orthodox views that eventually he convinced David to prepare for the priesthood himself. David is now living in Jacksonville as an active priest, while he also serves as the president of a seminary. Although he was not ordained a priest until the early 90s, he has been a Christian counselor for nearly 30 years. In that time, he has treated most every form of emotional distress you can imagine. He is a perfect example of the cliché wounded healer. After spending 10 years in Sumter, South Carolina, he returned to Jacksonville in April of 2007 and was gratefully assigned the task of building St. James Catholic Charismatic Church. This is joyful work, to say the least. Thank you for listening.